Hello and welcome to Low Society. We are in the year 2021, where weakness is strength, where, you know, collusion equals democracy. Very exciting time to be alive.
War is peace.
War is peace, yep.
Weakness is strength.
Yep. Welcome to Orwell's Oceania. Today we have a really amazing guest for you. We have James Smith from The Popular Show. Would you like to introduce yourself and let people know where they can find you, what you do?
Yeah, sure. Delighted to be here. I'm a long-time listener. You can find me at New Populism, like New Metal, NU. I wrote Other People's Politics, Populism to Corbynism with Zero Books. With my friend Mirella Fannebecker, I wrote Work, Want, Work, Labour, and Desire at the End of Capitalism. That's with Zed Books. You can find me on The Popular Show once a week as well.
Brilliant. Thank you for coming here to sip tea on American democracy with us. We very much appreciate it. The whole AOC fiasco that's been unfolding has been absolutely insane to watch. It's one of those like very sort of rare moments where you sort of see the crack in the whole strength of weakness thing, because usually the weakness aspect is used as this moral cover that's almost impermeable. It's almost impossible for you to question it without looking as if you want to do quote unquote marginalized people harm. But then there are these rare moments where the strength within that sort of feigned weakness comes forward. And I feel like these opportunities are ones that we should maximalize to sort of point out how this dynamic works.
Well, it's the very public, cynical usage of it, isn't it? Mm. And that is kind of what brings the most attention to it. And I mean, it happens on a smaller scale all the time, mm-hmm. but it's like these ones that it's these very huge figures doing it in this very cynical way.
Yeah. It's quite something to watch, really. I mean, she's becoming in her own way as strange and fascinating a figure as Trump himself. I slightly feel like we're almost into the episode where like the main character has been kicked off the show. So now we're having sort of auditions for who is going to be the kind of bizarre like, protagonist of politics.
It's like season three of Lost. Like we can't figure out like who the main character is anymore because a few of the really important ones are dead now.
Yeah. I don't know. I think like it's almost as a sort of as a performance that she's interesting right now. I've got nothing to sort of say about her personally. It's absolutely true that insofar as there were successes for the left populist experiment of the Bernie and Corbyn years, the fact that policies left-wing people were asking for are still part of the national conversation after Bernie. Yeah, okay, that's kind of a tick. Like, I've no sort of cause myself to question her. It's the specific, like, deployments in this moment, her own trauma, her own past and sexual assault that she's revealed this week. The way that that kind of politics is suddenly being incentivized and rewarded. And also, I think, like, the sort of incredibly partisan way in which people are responding to this, that I feel like left-wing people who would have been very critical of this in other politicians, who even were very kind of critical of versions of this kind of performance from Elizabeth Warren only a year ago, are really closing ranks right now.
I'm gonna close ranks right now. Welcome to Low Society. I am Peter Coffin. Angie Speaks and Jake are here as usual, rocking and rolling. This podcast is available everywhere, so follow us on Spotify or Apple Music. Leave us reviews if you can. 5 stars, none of that 4-star bullshit, only 5. Tell your friends about Low Society, about this anti-establishment podcast they have to hear. And if you particularly want to support us, it's patreon.com/lowsocietypod. We have bonus episodes weekly. Those go out to patrons and patrons only. And there's a Parasocial Pals tier at $25 to get your voice on the podcast. Normally, we do that on episodes where we don't have a guest. Today, James is with us. Let's continue on.
But I want to explore the kind of notion of strength of weakness, because I don't think it's something that people fully understand or are fully able to articulate why this politics is being incentivized, like you said, and rewarded, and what the rewards specifically are. And I guess the way that I define strength of weakness is when, you know, the media or, you know, powerful figures represent themselves as helpless victims in order to create a moral cover. And it usually tends to work with people who have like serious positions of power. Like AOC isn't like some Bambi in the woods. She's like, you know, a representative of one of the most powerful governments on earth. And you sort of see this strength of weakness tactic deployed whenever they're trying to sort of conceal something. And it's not just something that, like, I brought up the Jesse Smollett. I don't even know how to pronounce his name. Sorry.
Juicy Smollett.
I brought up the Jesse Smollett incident because it was a similar sort of strength of weakness of, you know, this hate crime has been committed against me. I'm, you know, this helpless victim. Meanwhile, he's like a very rich actor on this like very successful show. And, you know, he got a lot of attention around it. But then when questions started to be raised around the validity of his claims, he sort of doubled down on the strength of weakness in order to sort of gaslight the people who were asking questions about, you know, the validity of what he claimed occurred.
I took a lot of shit for questioning that guy.
Yeah, same. Same.
I guess for me, I'd go back to Nietzsche on this one. In his book on the genealogy of morals, he actually describes it as like inherent to like a hell of a lot of the logic of Western thought itself, and certainly of Christianity. If you go back to the start of Christianity, this is a doctrine or ideology constructed on the position of marginalization, that the hero God is the guy on the crucifix. So it begins from that kind of
scene. That is a really good point.
Victimization, right? So Nietzsche describes this situation where he gives it a little kind of parable of his own, where some lambs are being attacked by eagles, and an eagle is turning up and carrying a lamb off every day. And so they say, well, you know, we're good and the eagles are bad. We're weak and the eagles are strong. Therefore, these two things must follow. Actually, strength must be the evil thing and weakness must be a sort of moral validity. And I mean, Nietzsche's position was that this continues to construct so much of the logic of the West. I guess now, in our particular kind of moment of neoliberalism, a neoliberalism that seemed to have been interrupted by disruptions on both the right and the left a few years ago, which now appear to have been neutralized, we're kind of in a position where across the board, people feel hard done by or marginalized by neoliberalism, which is inherently disempowering. All of us in some way feel like we're disempowered. And actually that somehow becomes quite a potent rhetorical thing. As far as the left are concerned, we've had a kind of cataclysmic failure and loss. And probably that kind of sense of weakness is getting mixed up with other impulses and feelings.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there. The way that the whole Bernie campaign and the Corbyn campaign in the UK went down, they really looked like, oh, we are gaining strength. We are building. We are going somewhere with this, even if it's not necessarily, you know, that these things were socialism or communism. It seemed like there was a sense there was some form of solidarity, some form of organization, and some building towards something. And then that just got squat down. So the interesting thing that you said there, that strength of weakness narrative is sort of being absorbed into those former movements, those people who feel like they were gaining strength.
I think that's an interesting excavation. But what I see is the eagle saying, I am the lamb, which is what makes me like, obviously, there's some kind of power culturally within the narrative of weakness that the powerful are now appropriating in order to suit their own aims.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, there's famously a kind of very right wing appropriation of Nietzsche, which would say, you know, oh, being an eagle is the great thing. But I think like the much more interesting point to be derived from the whole argument is that the lambs do become the eagles. The lambs do become hegemonic. The Christianity doesn't stay a persecuted sect for too long.
No.
There's a kind of muscle memory or a sort of scar tissue. That reflex remains. And that impulse to, for even when you're in power, to claim mm-hmm. to be the weakened one. And there's a version of it today on the right and on the left. And I think it should be the left's job, or the job of materialists, or whatever we want to call ourselves, to point that out and to kind of say, okay, you guys are both like kind of claiming the same thing of yourselves, and doing it in such a way that the other side can agree with it a million years. Maybe it's not a coincidence that you're both deploying the same kind of rhetoric at this moment. But unfortunately, there's a sort of brand loyalty with AOC, where I think a lot of people on the left aren't quite willing to criticize.
Absolutely.
I see that not just in AOC, but also in responses to the establishment, whenever the establishment seems to be playing out the aims of this so-called liberal left constituency, like the colluding with the FBI or colluding with big tech and all of those different aspects. There's sort of a sort of impulse to obfuscate the obvious in order to, like you said, stay true to this brand loyalty. And anyone who's sort of questioning these things is seen as aiding and abetting the quote unquote other side.
Yeah, on the subject of the whole sort of brand war, well, I think we all know how the media works in terms of disseminating brand messages, but understanding just how far they're willing to collude, I think it goes even further than that. Than the, you know, for our politics version of that, we need to look no further than this new Time article from yesterday called The Secret History of the Shadow Campaign That Saved the 2020 Election, which that's a hell of a title right there. Like, you're really in for a roller coaster when somebody claims they saved the 2020 election.
A shadow campaign implies, like, you know, nasty, like, sort of like bad behavior, though, doesn't it?
But it saved
the day.
Like, yeah, they're using the shadow campaign as the, like, immediate characterization. And then, like, immediately following, they contrast it within their own messaging with this, like, messiah thing. Like, we saved it. We saved the day. We're the heroes.
Elections are not conventionally saved.
No!
Won, elections, right?
Exactly. You either win it or you lose it. It's not really like something you salvage. Unless, of course, there was some serious problem in the way that things were being counted. But, you know, we trust our authority in terms of counting everything and certifying it and telling us the numbers, right? I will say that's one of the things that really bugs me about election rhetoric, is like they try to act like, like, it's so bizarre that anyone would ever question the results of an election. But, like, that is the case. Like, we literally trust authority, like, private and public authority, just telling us what the results of the election was. Like, there's so many, like, mediating platforms between somebody counting the ballots and us, the public. Nobody considers that it's actually not that weird to question it. It may not be correct. I'm not saying that, like, it's right or wrong, but it's weird to me. But then you have this kind of article come out, which is just like, it's like, you know what? You weren't weird to think that we were fucking with it. You weren't crazy.
Yep.
We were fucking with it.
Saved America from itself. That's what it is, you know. Saved America from itself.
Yeah.
I mean, we probably won't get through the whole thing. It's a long article, but, like, we don't have to get too far in to get the gist of it. A weird thing happened right after the November 3rd election. Nothing. Sorry. The nation braced for chaos. Liberal groups had vowed to take to the streets, planning hundreds of protests across the country. Right-wing militias were girding for battle. Which, by the way, like, they really think, like, nothing happened, and they're flipping out over January 6th, which is a thing that happened after the election, about the election. Just whatever. In a poll before Election Day, 75% of Americans voiced concern about violence. Instead, an eerie quiet descended. As President Trump refused to concede, the response was not mass action, but crickets. When media organizations called the race for Joe Biden on November 7th, jubilation broke out instead as people thronged cities. Thronged cities throughout. That sounds weirdly sexual to me. Like, is it me or like, do the liberals have a boner for all
they
of this
do.
Stuff?
They do. Big time. Big time. This is them like raining down the blue bukkake.
It's
all
the
bukkake.
It's yes, bukkake. It's we need our hazmat suits.
It's because they've written themselves as the Avengers in their own Marvel superhero story. And all of this.
Yeah, throng. This is comic book language, isn't it?
It is.
It really
throng.
Is.
Like, it's the sort of thing you can imagine seeing in an old Batman comic, like, as he whacks the bad guy. But that's, like, you know, this is why it saves America. This is why it's, like, because it's seen as, like, everyone that disagrees with us is the bad people.
Yeah.
We need to show
them. The end of Return of the Jedi after this election. Like, everybody, like, they toppled the statues of Palpatine and they're dancing in the streets. The Gungans are doing their drums and the Ewoks are playing their flutes and all that. Like, it's just like, it's bizarre. So anyway, the reason they were celebrating across the U.S. was to celebrate the democratic process that resulted in Trump's ousting. A second odd thing happened amid Trump's attempts to reverse the result. Corporate America turned on him. Hundreds of major business leaders, many of whom had backed Trump's candidacy and supported his policies, called on him to concede. To the president, something felt amiss.
Well, he did think that something was amiss. He had that moment, didn't he, when he pulled up the graphs and he said, look at this. Look right here. Look, this is where it happens. This is the fuckery. Yeah.
It was all very, very strange, Trump said on December 2nd. Within days after the election, we witnessed an orchestrated effort to anoint the winner, even while many key states were still being counted. I feel like they've set this up for you to go, what a dumbass, that fucking guy. I can't believe Trump would think something was amiss. And then the next sentence, the very next thing they say, in a way, Trump was right.
What the fuck? What the actual fuck?
This is like, sort of pseudo-novelistic writing where like this third person narrator, it's like Jane Austen or something. Is the narrator inside the head of Trump or not? Which bit was just Trump's thoughts? Which bit was a fact?
Is this George R. R. Martin where we're talking from point of view characters? It's just, it's, anyways.
Chapter 3, Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi rifled through her drawers to find turds that the protesters had left.
I kind of like the idea of Trump as this like misunderstood Elizabeth Bennet style character.
This is just like pathological writing, really, because it's like, oh, that surprise, surprise. In a way, Trump was right about everything, really. It's like conceding like so much to the whatever conspiracy theorist MAGA narrative and actually saying that, yeah, in quite a lot of ways, you were dead on, but the fact that you thought we were doing this was why we had to do
exactly.
it. It's kind of
self-justifying.
But that's the thing, is when you're a lamb, when you've convinced yourself that you're a lamb anyway, any measure is justified when it comes to quote unquote defeating the quote unquote eagles. So
the fash.
At the same time, I mean, it's just taking on like precisely a kind of QAnon view of the world. It is a sort of BlueAnon, a great example of BlueAnon.
Yep. BlueAnon, yes.
We assumed the election was going to be stolen. We had to save the election. Even whatever QAnon's kind of idea of saving their children.
Save the election in the same terms as spread democracy here.
Well, yeah, exactly. But just two sides with the same kind of absolute, like, symptoms of the breakdown of any kind of social contract, accusing each other of basically the same thing while admitting to doing like the same thing that they accuse the other side of.
There was a conspiracy unfolding behind the scenes, one that both curtailed the protests and coordinated the resistance from CEOs. Like, that's literally like they're saying, we manufactured consent. We did the whole thing. We did that book. Both surprises were the result of an informal alliance between left-wing activists and business titans. The pact that formalized in a terse, little-noticed joint statement of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO published on Election Day. Both sides would come to see it as a sort of implicit bargain, inspired by the summer's massive, sometimes destructive racial justice protests, in which the forces of labor came together with the forces of capital.
Wow.
Right there. That's the dead giveaway is right there. To keep the peace and oppose Trump's assault on democracy.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Like, this is like Orwellian levels of just gaslighting. Like,
And they really hammer it home. Like, the next sentence is the handshake between business and labor, which was just one component of a vast, quote unquote, and I'm putting the quotes here because this is fucking horseshit, cross-partisan campaign to protect the election, an extraordinary shadow effort dedicated not to winning the vote, but ensuring it would be free and fair, credible and uncorrupted. Dedicated not to winning the vote.
This feels like Mike Cernovich or something.
Yeah, I feel like yes.
It's
Cernovich type language here. Like it's so disingenuous in how it's talking about. For more than a year, a loosely organized coalition of operatives scrambled to shore up America's institutions.
Well, using all that language and like with labor and capital working together and left wing, like it's not really, I mean, they're liberal activists, aren't they? And there's constant use of labeling these people as left wing and like of them as the labor force. And like, I mean, everyone's a labor force. So I mean, we can't really take that away from them in some respects, but it's not like, when you're talking politically about that, it's not really this. They're not the people you're thinking of, is it?
It's the same sort of gaslighting tactic that they use. It's like a completely disorganized mess of political concepts and language that's sort of twisted in a way that supports their agenda, basically. But the interesting thing is telling people about this stuff, like pointing out the stuff, the strength of weakness and all of this different stuff. It's almost as if telling kids that Santa isn't real almost. It's almost the same reaction that you get from people, even though the information is out there and it's plain and it's obvious. There are certain people that just won't believe it. Why do you think that is? Why? What is the cognitive dissonance there?
Yeah, I mean, this article is kind of batshit, but presumably is like rooted in some, presumably these metaphors of handshakes and embraces and whatever else, and thronging. Presumably these metaphors are based on like some actual conversations or joint planning between, I don't know what, left liberal NGO kind of groups. Is that what we mean when we're talking about labor and capital here? But as like crazy as this article is, it is also literally true. I mean, it was like the day after Bernie conceded to Joe Biden as candidate, that Current Affairs and all the other kind of organs of Bernie world were crowding in to immediately kind of put on the blackmail for getting behind Biden. There wasn't even a kind of moment of brattiness, really. That it was straight in to getting absorbed into this kind of machine. So, you know, it's a good example of how every time you think, like, the analysis of the post-left is kind of intriguing, but ultimately an exaggeration. It's only a few months before an article like this comes out and kind of just confirms the worst kind of analysis of the situation.
The most amazing thing is, like, it's a long article. We're never going to be able to get through the whole thing. But later on, they like cite specific people who are like organizers from specific
organizations and stuff.
Yeah, different organizations, specific people. Like you've got this Catalyst place, the CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and stuff. Like they spoke of like 150 different quote unquote liberal organizations. The coalition was called Protect the Results. The Women's March was part of it. The Sierra Club, Color of Change, Democratic Socialists of America. They were all part of this Protect the Results coalition. There was 150 liberal groups, and like they do cite people in this. It's not just like some vague like, oh, look at this stuff. Like it is actually sourced from real conversations they had with people who were detailing actually what's going on. And like they even characterize in the course of the article that the people who are behind this are just aching to tell it so people will know exactly how far they had to go to, quote unquote, protect democracy.
It's fascinating to me the difference between the UK and the US in all this. I mean, what we're seeing in the US right now is like, to use a phrase that Luke Boltanski and Eve Chappello used, it's a new spirit of capitalism. They described how neoliberalism, you know, kind of, it's a story that's been told a lot of different ways, took aspects of new left aesthetics from the 60s in order to kind of shore up and justify itself. Nancy Fraser gives the version of how second wave feminism and many of its kind of demands for women ended up being embraced by neoliberalism. And she calls it the cunning of history, where the left thinks for a moment it's winning and then actually just gets totally absorbed into a yet more exploitative version of capitalism. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing a Biden-Harris administration, which is just, you know, these people are the worst excesses of pretty much every awful thing you can name about America, mass incarceration.
Directly involved people at higher levels. A prosecuting attorney who put tons of people in jail and the guy who wrote the 1994 crime bill. These people are directly involved in the opposite of the shit that they're supposed to be for.
And they're able to represent themselves as the pinnacle of anti-racism, the pinnacle of anti-fascism, the leaders of this popular front. And the left has quite willingly gone along with it. And I mean, we, you know, it's the constant temptation of leftism to collapse into liberalism. And that's been true for as long as there's been a left. You can't be on the left in capitalist society without that being the kind of thing tugging on your sleeve. But I guess with AOC, almost the sort of perfect example. Usually I've thought, okay, it's a shame that the left ends up compromising itself. But actually, she and the kind of brand of leftism that she represents is more partisan than the normal centrist shit-lib Democrats. That's the kind of painful thing to realize, really, that actually it's not that they're just going along with it. They're at the forefront of this current project and currently are giving the validation to... well, you know, you had the director of the former director of counterterrorism from the CIA, Robert Grenier, saying that we now have a situation analogous to, you know, insurgents in Iraq in the early 2000s. At home in America. And that's another perfect example, like whatever post-left people saying, oh, the Capitol building's going to be, you know, used as a sort of 9/11.
Absolutely.
And like one of the things that I think drives this sort of willingness to capitulate to liberalism is the fact that a lot of leftists see, or people who sort of claim to be on the left, they see the liberal establishment more as a problematic ally rather than as the, to quote Alex Jones, like demons on earth that these people actually are. They see them as like a problematic kind of, you know, ally, like your zany uncle.
Well, exactly. I think that the left will fail until it is as repulsed in its bones by neoliberalism and by anyone who was involved anywhere near the Iraq war, as it is by petty bourgeois nationalism. At the moment, these two things, petty bourgeois nationalism is absolutely despised and to a great extent rightly so, but yeah, you're totally right. The other side is just a problematic ally, when actually there isn't a left until both of those things are totally
we can't look at things from the perspective of left and right, just simply. Like, if we're looking at things between a gradient between left and right, then we end up with this idea that the liberals, which are the left wing of capital, are somehow closer to us when they're actually antagonistic towards us. That's the thing that sort of blows my mind, is this idea that people can't separate the left and right wing of capital as capital. Maybe people who disagree about how capital should be appropriated, how what is acceptable in terms of like cultural like specifications. This is why it's becoming such a difficult prospect to say the word left, is because people are so happy to just sort of blend like what a definitional left, an anti-capitalist, pro-power to the people force, with the aesthetic of the left that has been appropriated by the neoliberal capitalist structure. It's just, we need to be able to make that distinction, which means we can't accept the neolibs, the libs, the shit libs, the rad libs as problematic allies. We have to push back against them as like part of capital, ideologically speaking, at very least.
Yeah. Can I give a couple of examples of this to kind of illustrate the point? I mean, think back to 2016 and Hillary Clinton making the famous speech about the basket of deplorables. Like, didn't everyone know at the time that this was terrible, that this was an absurd, you know, self-defeating and ultimately immoral thing to say? We all knew that.
I wrote an article about it asserting that.
Yeah. But today, I just don't think that it would get that kind of pushback. I mean, like AOC, okay, she goes on stage for her little 5 minutes at the DNC, whatever it is, the pre-election conference. And this was interpreted as a sort of humiliation. The Bernie wing only gets, you know, a few minutes to say its piece and then gets told to piss off. But then after, and she talks about universalist policies and so on. Then afterwards on Instagram, she's doing the whole kind of Popular Front thing. We've got to unite against fascism. Names this kind of list of minority groups, somehow poor people. they're not on the list. And now it's these people who don't really have any interests in common, you know, as far as how she's describing them, but they have to temporarily unite to defeat fascism. Any sense that we don't call people deplorables because we want to stress the material interests that the vast majority of people who are screwed over by capitalism have in common, any sense that that is our project, cutting through to the fact that actually there are material interests that we have in common, that just seemed to have completely evaporated in the rhetoric as Bernie was defeated.
That's the reason why materialists, or people who are sort of lumped into the post-left basket of deplorables, are such a threat to these establishment figures. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why they want to label materialism reactionary as well, because it sort of cuts through these divisions that they're trying to create, the good people versus the basket of deplorables, the sort of the eagle lamb hybrids versus the nebulous threat of the like supercharged like Gundam eagles that are coming to like, you know, destroy democracy.
Yeah, the Gundam eagles, which are, by the way, also just poor people.
Yeah. It's only become more histrionically and pathologically insisted on in the face of like the complete empirical failure of this argument about Trumpism, when, you know, as you all know, Trump, you know, massively increases his vote, his vote, and does so in every category except white affluent white men. So this coalition only got bigger, 75 million people. It only got more diverse. And so what's the response? Not, okay, clearly, you know, something was cutting through about this, or clearly, like, if it wasn't for COVID, then Biden-Harris would have been completely humiliated and rejected. There's no kind of reckoning of that kind and a sort of return to, like, that wisdom we had in 2016, 2017. Instead, it's a kind of rhetorical slippage where, like, the people who were in the Capitol building all dressed up and wrapped in the Confederate flag are representative of that entire 75 million, which is what you think if you listen to this kind of dominant media language about it right now. you know, we're going to need a bigger basket.
I think you just came up with the title of Hillary Clinton's second memoir.
We're going to need another basket. Oh, my God. They tried to pull this rhetorical, the statistical thing, where they took the statistics of the jobs that were held by people who were arrested in the Capitol Hill thing. And they were like, the top three jobs that, like, the most people were arrested were, like, owner or, like, self-proprietor or some shit like that. I don't remember what they exactly were, but they were like very obviously petite bourgeois jobs. And like these fucking articles use the word petite bourgeois. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, where were you last year with that shit? Anyways, so there were like 48 people arrested and 18 of them had jobs that you might consider petite bourgeois rather than working class. The other 30 people... had working class jobs. Like, I'm sorry, but like there were more working class people.
I wouldn't have thought they could have got the day off.
The thing is they bust so many people in. Like they made it worth people's time. They got people on these buses from Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania. They're like four busloads of like 60, 70 people on each of these buses that were working class. Of course there was a lot of working class people arrested. But the thing is, they don't want us to look at it that way. They're like, the top three jobs were petite bourgeois, obviously. Leftists, like, please repeat this information when you see it.
Yeah. Well, you get the exact same kind of discourse around Brexit in the UK. That despite the fact that, no one's saying everyone who voted for Brexit was, you know, the true proletariat. That was never the argument. The point is that enough working class people.
Exactly.
Enough working class people support Brexit. Mm-hmm. But even so, like this idea that, small business owners, we don't need, you know, fuck them then. That is the most politically ridiculous kind of thing to be saying during a pandemic, which is wiping out small business, wiping out the high streets, and to some extent, happily and deliberately.
Beyond that, in an era where they're forcing everybody into contract situations where they're technically self-proprietors in most of, like, Uber drivers, DoorDash delivery drivers, all these people, they're technically business owners. Like, they are self-proprietors of a business that they're contracting their labor out to, like, Uber. We can't even rely on that distinction, really, in terms of, like, who is genuinely working class, because they've shifted the language so much in order to avoid having to give people insurance.
One of the questions that I have to round out is how one of the problems that our sort of milieu has to troubleshoot is how we combat strength of weakness. Because one of the reasons it's so difficult to permeate is because it's designed to make you look like the perpetrator of hatred or the perpetrator of marginalization or abuse. Towards people who are ridiculously powerful. So there's an absurdity aspect to it, but there's also a sort of moral cover that's incredibly difficult to permeate. What advice do you have in terms of how to deal with strength of weakness when we see these sorts of moments arise?
Yeah, I think strength needs to be pointed out and stressed, really. I mean, here's an example. Like this whole thing about what building AOC was in during the Capitol riots. So the accusation is the part of the building she was in never had any rioters in it. And it's taken about a month for this to kind of actually get any traction, almost all on right-wing sites. AOC's reply is, but you're denying how traumatized I was by it or the fact that I felt unsafe. Yeah, okay, but that's not really the question. The question is, what were you actually safe? There is a differentiation that kind of needs making. I'm kind of amazed to see this because it really reminds me of a couple of things that happened with Jeremy Corbyn. In 2016, I don't know if you guys were especially paying attention to Corbyn before the 2017 election because we were kind of lost at this point, but he did this little video where he was on a train, a privatized train, and he sort of sits down and does this little phone footage video where he's sort of saying, look at all these people sat down on the floor in the train because our privatized trains are so rampacked and full. And immediately, like, you know, there was CCTV footage released of like, oh, are there some seats on the train? People were like printing out sort of the number of tickets sold, and every mm-hmm. kind of element of what he said got sort of picked over. Then a couple of years later, something similar happened, like more seriously, with this accusation that when he'd been at this commemoration of the victims of Operation Wooden Leg, this Israeli airstrike on the PLO headquarters in Tunisia, this kind of mm-hmm. argument that, oh, he'd been there to commemorate the victims of the airstrike. Was he also laying a wreath at these PLO terrorists' graves as well? And the maps come out, and all of this kind of picking over of every detail of what he said, like, it goes mm-hmm. into force. Compare that to AOC's, like, obviously fudged claim that where she mm-hmm. combines the fact that she felt unsafe or whatever with the expected inference that we're to make that she actually was physically unsafe.
Yeah.
Which, that fudge is made. Compare those two situations. Corbyn, like, was absolutely rinsed, and you know, even if he'd been telling the truth about the whole thing, like, there was enough doubt sown by how repeatedly
mm-hmm. yeah.
asked to exactly. like, examine these maps and so on. Compare that to now, where actually a month passes with no scrutiny whatsoever of AOC's claim. If this was our revolution, if the left, if the squad were this kind of, you know, threat to the Democrats, if they were, you know, something that, you know, if they reflected the kind of left self-image, then would that be the case? Would it be the case that, you know, Michael Tracy, relatively anodyne and unremarkable kind of ribbing of AOC's mawkish, sentimentalized video gets kind of treated as this appalling abuser himself?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, God.
We just had Michael on last week.
We just had him on as well last week. It's crazy to see the way that the script gets flipped as soon as that strength of weakness sort of veneer is invoked. And yeah, I think that you had it right when you said that the way we combat this is by continuously and loudly pointing out the strength aspect. Yeah. Do you think that that's enough, or is there anything else that we can do to combat this?
Oh, I don't know. Well, we shouldn't do it ourselves. That's the starting point. Like, our whole kind of media ecosystem, the whole kind of online infrastructure is set up to reward these kinds of performances. That's the only materialist reading available of Me Too. The fact that Me Too showed how there's something about our digital infrastructure that rewards these, like, very kind of personalized and almost kind of pornographic performances of trauma. Mm-hmm. AOC appears to be simply kind of picking that up as a rhetorical weapon. So we shouldn't do it ourselves, but we should also, encourage people not to reward it, really.
Of course, which is why I'm not saying we should employ strength of weakness at all, but it's sort of frustrating as a woman, especially, to watch this kind of pornographic exploitation of trauma narratives play out and become codified into the way one is supposed to express trauma. You're supposed to sort of keep it in a cachet as like a weapon to then sort of bring out when the moment is right. It's also supposed to be performed and displayed in front of people. And the idea that, you know, part of the reason why there's a difference between the way AOC is treated and Jeremy Corbyn is treated as well is because Jeremy Corbyn embodies what is deemed hegemonic, like the white male oppressor type of thing. And AOC is this like genteel woman of color, and therefore she must be sort of coddled and protected and listened to and believed. It's sort of a perversion and inversion of hegemonic systems that were once in place, but not a true demolishing of those ideologies and systems.
I see it as almost like the reverse underpants gnomes defense, which you may be familiar with in South Park, where basically she goes, Ted Cruz murdered me. Oh my God, but what's stage two? Stage one was that I had this really traumatic experience a long time ago, and you're like, okay, well, that's kind of like completely derailed anything from, but what's stage two? I don't know, but stage three is that Ted Cruz tried to fucking murder me. Did you hear me? Like, yeah. And I think the extra scrutiny on the question mark under stage two is like how we kind of make people see that a lot of the time it's like when there is cynically used and you can see that just like, just make it so fucking obvious. Like, I mean, it's just ridiculous at this point.
AOC herself, you know, talked about pushing to the left and saying, you've got to push me when I'm in there. And, you know, we all sort of like buy into this idea. But do people think it looks, it's nice to be pushed? You know, Jimmy Dore, yeah. Michael Tracy, these people come across as kind of obnoxious or whatever. But that is what it looks like to mm-hmm. kind of fly yeah. in the face of.
You exert pressure.
Political. Yeah, exactly. It's political pressure has a certain unpleasantness to it, and rightly
absolutely
no, because they see themselves as like courtiers, these sort of genteel courtiers, mm. and we're just like rabble and, you know, behaving in this sort of uncivilized manner, and we're supposed to sort of gently and softly kind of caress the curves of power rather than doing the actual pushing. But all this sort of talk about pushing to the left is bullshit. Like, they're here to push everyone else to the right,
yeah,
which is the real sort of crux of what's going on right now.
It's funny you mentioned Jimmy Dore, because I feel like this whole strength of weakness slams becoming Eagles is exactly the TYT story, where they're like, oh, we're this small independent, like, you know, thing, and you need to fund us to get the real truth out there, guys. And then eventually they're just like completely bought in by like the Clinton Foundation and like the entire like thing.
But that's what happens when you don't elucidate a specific politics that is critical of capital structures from the start, because you are not accountable to that critique at any point because you didn't make it. And that's the big problem here. With that, anyways.
Definitely. But the idea that, it does trouble me that the idea that she's managed to sort of create this strength of weakness veneer so expertly to the point where she's almost beyond reproach now.
Yeah.
And anyone who tries to sort of point the obvious out or criticize her is immediately chucked into the ever-expanding basket of deplorables. Like you said, I've seen a lot of people saying, people like Michael Tracy, people like Jimmy, anybody who isn't like a woman of color or something who's sort of pointing this stuff out is this white male abuser.
Oh, well, Bree's been treated very, Breonna Gray's been treated very badly.
That's true.
Well.
Yeah.
I have as well. Like me, it's not, and if you are, I was going to go on to say, if you are a woman of color, you're told that you have internalized misogyny or that you're just plain up, not black.
Who put you up to this?
Yeah, who put you up to this? Or
who put you up to
you're not
this?
Actually black, which I've gotten as well quite a few times. Like, you're just sort of.
Well, I mean, that whole you ain't black if you ain't voted for Joe Biden thing, that's come to manifest.
Yeah, I'm a transracial, like, misogynist white supremacist, apparently. That's my new identity.
Candace Owens has gotten in your DMs. Come on.
The Koch brothers paid for that TV, right?
Yeah.
You're called a grifter. You're helping the aiding and abetting the other side. There's this sort of demand of loyalty at all costs, and even if it is a lie, why are you saying that it is? Because you're helping the other side. Like, I've literally seen people say that, like, you're supposed to cover for this side. It's this sort of implicit kind of you know, under the radar public secret that even if our side is even if what we perceive as our side is lying, even if they are doing the work of obfuscation, you're supposed to cover for us, and you're not supposed to air out dirty laundry. It's like being in a bad marriage almost. It's fucking awful.
Yeah, I mean, these are the two paths for the left while there's a totally demobilized working class. Either you end up Oedipus at colonists, like the Corbynites out in the cold, tarred as everything under the sun, anti-Semites, the most evil, you know, Corbyn, the greater villain, voted greater villain than Jeffrey Epstein. Either
crazy.
Is that, or you gradually sort of shift your language to a sort of depoliticized identity politics. You become the Jiminy Cricket conscience of a neoliberal party, and you have a pretty good time. I can see how the temptation is there.
Yeah,
but
you basically become bread tube, is what you're saying.
Yes.
You can tell who's voting in those polls if they think Corbyn was not as much of a villain as Epstein. It must have been all of his mates. Just like
he probably hired like a Russian bot thing, like, because, you know, the Russian bots are so real. He probably got his own.
It was part of the feedback survey at the end of the last Bilderberg meeting, so they made sure that they got the right votes.
No, but honestly, I'm okay to be, you know, out in the cold with Oedipus. Like, I don't care. Like, I'm fine being in the ever expanding basket of deplorables. It's better to fucking serve in hell, sorry, reign in hell than serve in heaven, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned. And if that's the option that's available, then I'd rather do that than become the Jiminy Cricket caged monkey.
Same.
For a neoliberal order. And it's sad because I've been seeing a lot of people who I know sort of deep down or intuitively have these critiques, but sort of like suppressing them. It's almost like watching caged lions like in a zoo. And you want, and I feel like it's just going to take a few people to sort of give people permission to sort of break out and be more honest and stop obfuscating. But there's a lot of pressure not to, especially if you're within the media, there's pressure to continue the work of obfuscation, also to tap into that sort of audience, which is vast and also more willing to part with their money to support, you know, people and stuff like that. There's a lot of pressure to sort of tap into that audience consciousness and continue to reinforce the norms. And within that sort of audience itself, there's a desperate need to have something to hold on to. They still want to believe in the Bernie vision. They still want to believe that the Democratic Party are just sort of problematic allies that can be shifted left.
They want to believe that the DSA isn't the don't clap, do jazz hands thing. They want to believe that the DSA is somehow a real revolutionary force at this point.
Mm-hmm. They want to believe in the Santa Claus narrative. And it's difficult when you're in that environment not to fall prey to it. And a lot of people do. But I guess being steadfast is the only option you have, unless you want to, like you said, become a Jiminy Cricket.
Hold the line, as they say.
Yeah, hold the fucking line.
I mean, that was another good example of them just like totally like basket of deplorables. Sorry. They're doing bad stocks. They're taking the stock market away from our precious like fucking Wall Street bankers, our very diverse Wall Street bankers.
Well, that's a great example. I mean, Ted Cruz, you know, says to AOC, people on the right hate Wall Street as well, or support Reddit on this as well. Let's work together. And Now we've got this capital thing that is just there as an excuse in the back pocket to never work with, never call the bluff of a Republican again. You know, people on the left love saying, oh, Tucker, Ted Cruz, etc. They're just faking this populism. Yeah, but when they offer it publicly, it is available to us to actually like expose them.
Stick them to it. Stick them to it. Make them do it.
Yeah, like, make them do it. Exactly.
That's exactly what I thought. Like, I don't think that Ted Cruz is fucking like, I don't think that man has a bone in his body that actually gives a shit about any of the people who are putting their money in on this GameStop thing. He doesn't give a fuck. He gives a fuck about what he's going to get attention for. And that's the thing that he's going to get attention for. And AOC could have used his cynicism as a means to force him to act a certain way and didn't. And that's the fucking problem right there. She instead decided that she needed to assert that he burst into her office during the Capitol raid with two revolvers and was like, I'm going to kill you.
I would have loved to see that movie for sure. Just him in like a ski mask. But
that probably is going to happen in the film version, you know?
Yeah, probably. They're going to make like Olympus Has Fallen part two.
It'll be The Capitol Has Fallen. And it will be, you know, AOC defending herself in her office with like a Wonder Woman whip and a shield.
Yeah, for sure. But it's been crazy. But I think we all just have to stay vigilant. And again, like hold the line, as Jake said, we have to fucking hold the line against this stuff.
I think it's just worth like remembering that our take on this is the more normal one.
Absolutely.
Outside the, you know, cut and thrust of the, you know, online meatpacking plant, actually, this is a normal analysis of the situation. Not like, you know, if you don't abandon all critical faculty whatsoever in the face of a garbled survivor narrative about the Capitol attack, then you yourself are a monster.
Yeah, but when you say normal, you're reinforcing like the idea that it's wrong to be weird.
Before we round out, James, will you say thronging for us one more time?
Absolutely. I've had a thronging good time.
Yes, I love it. Same. I love it. Will you also, because I always ask guests this, what's your astrology sign?
I'm a Capricorn. Capricorn to my bones. Yeah.
Nice. Very, you know, earthy sign. Capricorn to my bones. Very earthy sign, very strong, you know. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And yes, find James. All his plugs are at the beginning. Watch the popular show as well. Got great guests on there. I was on there a few weeks ago. Great speakers as well. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you guys in the audience for listening to us today. Also, feel free to help us out on Patreon. And next week, when we don't have a guest on, we'll be reading more of the parasocial Patreon questions and also the ones from the emails too.
But send us the questions anyway at lowsocietypodcast@gmail.com.
Awesome. Talk to you guys later. Goodbye.
Peace out.